Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight, the Movie Geeks celebrate the 10th anniversary of the DVD format with special guests, including one of the most respected film critics in the country, whose review columns on the latest DVD releases are a must-read for movie fans everywhere. From USA Today, critic Mike Clark. Plus, she's produced some of the most remarkable works under the Criterion Collection banner, including Boogie Nights, Seven, Spellbound, and the upcoming Tulane Blacktop, Susan Arcegi. And want to know what the Blu-ray and HD DVD formats are all about? The Movie Geeks bring in the expert, USA Today entertainment reporter Mike Snyder. Now, dim the lights, grab the popcorn, and get ready to get your geek on. Here are your hosts for tonight's episode of Movie Geeks United, Jamie, Jerry, and Aaron.
It is Movie Geeks United, a special Sunday night, two-hour episode celebrating the 10th anniversary of DVD. Thank goodness. Are we on the air? Is this real?
I think it's as real as we're going to get, so yeah.
It is real. It is no longer a dream.
That's right. It was a dream a couple of hours ago. We had a couple of technical glitches, but we got those fixed, and we're working on getting our guests on 2 hours past the time that they're originally scheduled to come on, but... We do have some great guests and a great show planned for you tonight. No matter when we were able to eventually come on, it's still a great show, and we're pleased that you're all with us tonight. So let's start out. We're celebrating the DVD format. It's a little different from our past tributes that we've done for Brian De Palma and David Lynch and Al Pacino and character actors. Aaron was instrumental in getting this thing put together for us because he was the first one to bring to my attention that DVD was approaching its 10th year anniversary. And so I thought, what a perfect subject for a two-hour tribute, because it really is a medium that has changed quite a lot for both the home entertainment crowd and the movie industry as a whole. I mean, the repercussions of this technology have been huge.
Astronomical.
Yeah, yeah. And so we're going to explore the history of the DVD format, what we most enjoy about it, and the future of the format as well with the experts. We're calling in the experts to help us out on this one. But just a couple of notes before we get started. You can subscribe to our show via iTunes. Don't have to worry about it starting late or anything like that. It just downloads right into your into your iTunes menu there. You can click the subscribe to iTunes icon on the right hand side of your Blog Talk Radio
the
screen.
Steve Jobs Love Fest.
And then Blog Talk Radio is great, by the way. They worked to fix this glitch, and we're on now, and we couldn't be more thrilled. Or you can type in Movie Geeks United in the search engine of iTunes, and that'll bring up all of our episodes. You can also access all of our archive episodes on our Blog Talk Radio page. Great interviews with Joe Pantoliano, John Ottman, Howard Shore, Academy Award winners, guys. I mean, come on. And last Wednesday's show was great. We had the screenwriter of Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, the new Sidney Lumet film that's getting raves. And we had the director of The Game Plan, which just opened up in first place with 22-something million dollars. So.
He was a lot of fun. He was a good-natured guy. I liked him a lot.
He was hysterical. He was great. So our guests are ready to go. We're still trying to get in touch with USA Today critic Mike Clark to let him know of the schedule change. So as soon as we have that done, Aaron, just let us know.
All right, yeah. But
we will patch him in. Aaron's trying to contact him as we speak. So we're on a roll here. So first of all, let's talk about when we were first introduced to the DVD format.
Well, let's go a little further back. Let's talk about the home video market. Jamie and Jerry, I'll ask you, do y'all remember the first VCR y'all got and some of the first tapes that, you know, became like staples?
A top loader.
Oh, really?
A Hitachi top loader from 1980.
Wow.
We didn't start renting movies till probably, we didn't join a video club actually till like 83 or 84. Because we were really, you know, we went to the movies or we watched them on TV. It was, and also to rent them at first, I think, was pretty expensive from what I remember.
They were like $3-4, and you had to take them back the next night.
Yeah, I mean, it changed as it became chains and everything, and but it was amazing. It was because actually at this time HBO was just or the pay TV thing was starting too. So I remember like there was a choice between HBO and Super TV.
Right.
That was your two choices back in like the early 80s. And then the home video, then the idea of going to the, hey, let's get a video tonight or something,
yeah,
became part of the common, you know, by 84, that was pretty common.
It was like, I remember growing up as a kid, it was like, our first VCR was one of them RCA Bad Boys, you know, those things that weighed, you know, you know they throw your back out, you know, and they cost $800.
Tell me about it.
And remember those tapes were heavy back then, too. And I remember, and it's funny, I've been watching TV lately, like channel surfing, and some of the movies that were like, you know, Friday night staples of renting are now like being circulated on Showtime like every other day. Like, it's funny because the other day I saw Showtime has been showing all month Fright Night.
Yeah.
Remember that Tom Holland's?
Tom Holland.
They're remaking that, I believe.
They are?
Yep.
And so I remember that was a staple of, you know, that was something I rented like, you know, probably every other month. Rent that. I mean, Fright
That's
Night
right.
was a cool movie.
I remember those days, yeah.
You know, you'd rent Fright Night or, you know,
what was the first movie you rented, though? What?
I actually think, of all things, I think it was The Hobbit.
Really? Okay.
First thing, and, you know, probably wasn't a good copy, but, yeah, I remember The Hobbit. Aliens was, the Cameron Aliens was always
yeah.
big. So, yeah, it's, for some reason, it was always, like, horror films. Or,
oh,
like,
yeah, because we can't get into those.
Those were really easy
own,
to come
huh?
by.
Yeah.
The horror film market really cornered video,
video
huge way. I was visiting my grandmother with my mother one Sunday afternoon. We came home, and my dad had gone shopping earlier that day and brought home a Betamax machine.
Ooh. Oh,
yeah, yeah,
impressive.
And this was elaborate. This had the joggle knob.
Right,
you
right.
You could go at different speeds, and all, it was massive, and it was like a huge. It looked like a a stove. It was so big.
Well, I remember when they started, you know, like, it's probably around 86, they started hyping, like, when the big movies were now coming out on tape, and it was you were looking for the video store that was going to have the most copies, and you had to get there early in the morning before they get rented out by
yeah.
2 in the afternoon. I remember the first big title I can remember, like, Top Gun. I actually remember, like, commercials, like, saying, Top Gun, coming to video, and
yeah,
buy it also. Like when
Purple Rain for me was the big one when
oh,
I
really?
Remember that.
Well,
yeah.
to finish my story, when
yeah.
I came home,
yeah.
my father had already signed us up to some kind of video club rental service, and he got two. He doesn't have the best taste of movies. He got two movies, one of which I kind of fell in love with as a kid. The one of them was some kind of bad Charles Bronson 70s thing, and the other was Remo Williams' The Adventure Begins.
Oh,
that was fine for what it was.
I loved, you know, as a
I
kid.
I enjoyed that.
Yeah, as a kid, that was a great movie.
Yeah.
And
I was a big renter also with Joe Gray.
That's right. That's
remember
right.
Yeah, that was a great soundtrack from what I remember.
Remember that guy? He had the shiny teeth.
Yeah.
And that's how he broke the glass because he used the guy's teeth to, like, scratch the glass. I mean,
and I remember my parents renting, like, Scarface, and I couldn't enter the room. So automatically my interest was piqued as a kid about Scarface.
Well, remember, you know, Scarface and Godfather, remember there were like two cassettes?
Yeah.
We have several copies of those two cassette ones in the other room.
Yeah.
So did the Laserdisc revolution catch any of you guys? As brief as it was?
Yeah.
I came in, it was probably my favorite Christmas. It was Christmas 93, so I was 15. And I spent almost a little less than a year bothering my parents for it because what had happened a year earlier, Siskel and Ebert, which I was a regular viewer, they started the Pioneer Laserdisc of the Month pick. You know, they had their home video pick.
Sure.
And, like, 1 week out of the month was the Laserdisc pick. And I just started investigating Laserdisc. And so I remember I kept wanting a Laserdisc player. My parents were like, why? Like, you know, better sound, better quality, special features. And it's funny, I remember a few years earlier I was at a store and I saw these, now I know they were Laserdisc, but I thought they were movie soundtracks.
Ah, yeah, you made that mistake too, okay.
I was like, oh, look, wow. I was like, wow, Ferris Bueller's Day Off has a soundtrack, and I was like, that's kind of cool. And, but, you know, then I found later on I put two and two together. I was like, oh, these are the laser discs.
Mm.
But, yeah, and I got six laser discs that Christmas. I remember one of them was The Graduate, and I got The Player and Casablanca and a couple others. And then
the great ones to have.
And I get started buying. I remember for what I did, I would, like, not eat lunch every other day at school, and I would save my money. So, like, after 2 weeks, I'd have, like $30, and my parents would, like, put in the rest if I wanted to go buy a laser disc. So, like, one of the earliest ones I bought on my own with my own money was Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Well, I remember I was working at the movie theater. I was a manager there. I was in charge of all of their marketing efforts. And so I'd enter these contests that the studios held for the best marketing of their films. And I won many awards and cash prizes and all that kind of stuff. And but the first one I won was for a movie called Brain Scan, that Edward Furlong.
Oh, yeah, that one.
I plotted out some kind of marketing plan. I gave out a big hologram video arcade game, and so they liked it. So I got a $250, because this was a small studio, small movie, $250 grand prize. I took that money, I bought an open box Laserdisc player, and my first Laserdisc, Carlito's Way. And,
sweet.
Yeah, it was great. And I was officially hooked. I bought a total of like near 300 Laserdiscs. I would go to every weekend I'd go to the mall and I'd pick out, you know, I'd walk out with six or seven Laserdiscs every week. And, you know, because I was living with my parents at the time, I had no financial obligations, but, you know, since I moved out of their house last month, that's a joke, everyone. So when DVD came around, I was really upset because you can imagine I've invested tens of thousands of dollars because Laserdiscs were not cheap. And I gravitated towards the Criterion Collection discs because I really wanted to enhance my education of international cinema.
Right.
Criterion is invaluable, and they've remained an invaluable source.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Well, what's interesting to know, what we're talking about in the show, and we'll talk more when the Criterion representative comes on, is that, you know, Laserdisc, home video was mass market, everyone got it, and then Laserdisc was the niche market.
Yeah.
And then what DVD did is kind of combine that, and to the point where DVD has turned practically every consumer into a de facto movie geek, because whatever film they buy, I mean, some people may not even watch the features the first time they buy it, but they buy the DVD, and so they have, whether they like it or not, they have special editions in their hand.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
You know, so they have the special edition of any film that only the Laserdisc people were really craving for special edition.
Right.
You know, and so it's kind of, DVD has kind of become very democratic and turned pretty much everyone into a de facto movie geek.
Right. No, that's a good point, Aaron.
Yeah. I think that's what's kind of interesting. That's why this, and we'll talk about it later on with Mike Snyder, is that I think the problem with people aren't, at least in my opinion and what I've read on the HD and Blu-ray disc, is that it's turning into they're trying to create a mass market, but Blu-ray and HD is going to be that niche market, because I think for most people they're like, okay, how clearer can a picture get?
Yeah, are they going to come through the screen and punch me or something?
Yeah, exactly.
But so that'll be an interesting conversation. So Jerry, you'd never got into Laserdisc, or
it was, you know, we had already the first movies I bought were in 1989 on VHS.
Right.
You bought Batman, right?
I bought Batman, and Excalibur was the first one. The last movie I bought was in 99, Weekend, Godard's Weekend.
Wow.
And in between that, I would say 600 to 700 VHS tapes.
Uh-huh.
Was I upset about DVD, though? No. But when I worked at Borders during this time when it was introduced, so we would look what comes in. Not a lot of titles.
Mm-hmm.
Not until really, like you said, the Criterion titles started coming in. And then around the summer of 1990, I said, okay, I think it's time to switch over.
I think the first time that they started outgrossing VHS tapes, I think I read this today, was in 2003. So it took a little bit for DVD to become the absolute.
The first inkling where I saw that, I'd always had my money on DVD catching on, but I think the first time I really saw the potential was actually in the summer of 2000, I think it was August, when in one Tuesday, I think Magnolia, Terminator 2, Braveheart, and Boogie Nights all came out on
Yeah,
Disney.
It was in August because the Planet of the Apes box set came out. And so I bought that and all those films you just mentioned on DVD on the same day.
And so it was one of those like, okay, this is, I remember thinking, okay, here's a moment where we're really going to see this thing take off. And I think it really did.
I think you're right. I also think, though, when The Matrix came out on DVD in 99, the end of
that was the first film, if I remember correctly, that sold a million DVDs.
Yeah, we couldn't keep it in stock. Yeah. It was impossible to keep in stock, that film.
And well, you know, and so the thing with me, I never really bought a lot of tapes because early on, I guess this is the Siskel and Ebert training again, I was very adamant about letterboxing.
Mm. Oh, yeah. If it wasn't letterboxed, I didn't waste time with it.
And not many tapes were coming out in letterboxed.
It wasn't until like the mid-90s that they really, because you would see the option finally, like you go to Suncoast and say, I know I want
that's
the
right.
widescreen.
That's
and,
right.
Yeah.
And you know, Criterion, another real innovation of theirs is they really set the standard for letterboxing. I mean, they brought that out, and it became the standard as a result of their efforts, at least partly, because they were always adamant about it being shown, their laser discs and such, in their correct aspect ratio.
Yeah, well, I was watching I Shot Jesse James last night, Sam Fuller's first movie, and while it's not a particularly great film, I mean, it looks awesome. I mean, it's a fine presentation and everything.
Yeah. And, I had all of their – I had the 7. It was like an open – it was like a box set laser disc.
Do you still have them or
– No, I don't.
This is painful. Because as much as I love the 7 DVD, I know of the 7 laser disc where unlike the DVD, which is really amazing why they didn't do it on the DVD, but on the laser disc, you could actually freeze frame every page of the John Doe notebooks.
Oh, yeah. That's awesome.
And on the DVD, you would think this would be a no-brainer, but the John Doe notebooks are not on the DVD.
You had bloopers, which, you know, who doesn't want to see bloopers from 7? The most.
All right, can we just, I have to be excused.
And they were very funny, and you got a glimpse of truly the different acting styles between Brad Pitt and Morgan Freeman, because Brad Pitt was very loose and free and jovial a lot of times, and Morgan Freeman was very precise. You can tell he wants to get it down in as few takes as possible, and his disapproval of Brad Pitt's clowning around was right there front and center in some of the.
And I'm sure David Fincher is probably more on Morgan Freeman's side, knowing his fastidiousness about.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hey, Morgan Freeman spoke at my elementary school.
Really?
Yeah, he came. This must have been the mid-70s, mid to late 70s, and he was on the electric company.
Oh, sweet.
And, yes, of course, the kid in back of the ass was you and King Kong. And that was like we had explained to him, that was in 1933. There's no way Mr. Freeman could have been in that.
Were they implying that he was the title character?
No, nothing like that. They just asked, because that was like, you know, when you're growing up, and you remember, we don't have nothing. That was like, you know, one of those movies everyone talked about. You know, it was always on TV.
Right.
And yeah, the guy asked, "Is you and King Kong?" I'm looking, that's impossible. Even I know that's impossible.
Wow.
And Morgan
well, that's you were in a school for the gifted. Is that true?
I don't know what it was, but
that's terrible. Anyway, so when DVD came out, I was upset, but I eventually succumbed to the pressures of being a DVD owner. And I bought a player, an entertainment center, the whole thing, and I fell in love with DVD by their how compact they were. And just from a purely aesthetic point of view, I figured if I'm buying all of these, I want them to look good on my shelf. And I paid special attention to the spine. this is how extreme I am about DVDs. And Criterion had the best-looking spines.
No, that's it. See, you can't get much better than Criterion.
And they had that great new DVD smell.
I never really noticed the smell, but thank you. I'll look out for that.
Let's talk about two things. Well, let's talk about what was like one of the earliest worst things about DVD. Anyone here remember the dreaded days of those snapper cases that Warner Brothers?
Yeah. I have so many of those still.
that no one, you know, I mean, they, I mean, and Warner Brothers was just stubborn. They would not, everyone told them they don't like Snap. I mean, because they don't fit on the shelf nicely. They kind
right.
of stick out and they're kind of bulky.
Yeah.
And what was the first DVD? I'll start off by saying I joined like Columbia House DVD Club before I got the player.
Right.
So before I got the DVD player.
People like that, yeah.
I actually had like three, because I just knew it was going to take off. I had like three DVDs by Christmas when I got the player. So I mean, I had Boogie Nights, I had L.A. Confidential, and I had Gone with the Wind. The only thing that bugs me is that both L.A. Confidential and Gone with the Wind have now come out in a better edition, particularly Gone with the Wind, but also L.A. Confidential will be coming out in like a 10th anniversary edition.
God, it's been 10 years.
Yeah.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
I'm old. We're all old. But
yeah,
What was the first DVD purchases for some of y'all? Do you remember?
Go, Matrix, The Criterions for RoboCop, Hard Boiled, and High and Low.
You have some of the out-of-print DVDs.
Yes, I do. I have out-of-print DVDs.
Wow. The only out-of-print I have is Last Days of Disco.
Yeah, that's a good movie.
Actually, which is out of print. What about you, Jamie? Well, first DVDs?
You know, I honestly can't remember. I know that I'd make many late-night trips to Walmart, and I'd pick up as many as I could.
You robbed a lot of trucks, didn't you?
And the best place was Virgin Megastore. I'd drive to the Virgin Megastore, which is way out of town, and they'd have the biggest selection of DVDs of anyone, especially the Criterion stuff. And
yes,
they had
the best.
Yeah, they had, like, the really hard to find Criterion stuff, like maybe it's not as hard to find as I think, but I live in a little place in Florida. So.
Yeah, no, where you are, that's
yeah, stuff like M, Fritz Lang,
which now they've redone.
Yeah, which I absolutely fell in love with.
It
was like a big breakthrough for me to see that film, and Eight and a Half.
Yeah, I have that.
Yeah, just amazing movies. And if it wasn't for this company, I mean, I never would have, my eyes would never have been open, and especially Kurosawa. Their commitment to Kurosawa films is terrific, and I've seen, every one of their releases.
I feel like an idiot.
Why is that?
Washington, D.C. used to be real, and I don't think it's great, even though we have an AFI, the AFI Silver, and some Landmark theaters. We used to have great revival houses.
Right.
And we no longer have them anymore, the Biograph and the Key. And we went my mom would take us to see, a lot of those French films, Rules of the Game, what was the other one, Grand Illusion, and then we went to see The Hidden Fortress, and a couple of other films, of these films you're talking about on Criterion. And that's how we saw them, or we'd still watch them on PBS used to show them long ago.
Mm-hmm.
And no, but that's great. If that's how if Criterion's how you discovered them, that's awesome because
they are essential to anyone's
library.
We've discussed this before too, because when we did the Bergman Antonioni tribute show, that the revival houses used to be, they used to be popular near colleges, they used to be in many towns, and they don't exist anymore. And
no,
really, our revival houses are companies like Criterion that are doing such splendid work.
Yeah, I mean,
representing these classics of international cinema that, people are sorely lacking from people's vocabulary.
Yeah. I mean, there are still, in Los Angeles, you have the AFI, the Arclight, you have the New Beverly Cinema. Here we do have the AFI Silver, which does have a revival program. But I do miss when you could go to several places and see these. But I think this is where Criterion really comes in and does this magnificent sets a standard for everyone to follow.
Right, and there you mentioned the Rules of the Game, and that's another one of their recent efforts in the past couple of years.
Yes,
I really enjoyed and opened my eyes to that movie.
Well, have you? I don't know if y'all have heard, but it got announced of all places, the MTV movie blog, but it got announced, confirmed finally by Wes Anderson that Criterion is finally going to do Bottle Rocket.
Oh, that's awesome!
I doubt she'll give us many details, but I do know our Criterion guest has worked on all the Wes Anderson DVDs.
Yeah,
are great DVDs.
So one can assume that she might be working on the Bottle Rocket. Maybe we can get some kind of details on that, or at the very least. But
And you understand why directors gravitate towards Criterion.
Well, what's interesting about Wes Anderson, I'm assuming we'll have it confirmed that he must have it negotiated that his films go to Criterion because his films have been with, at least his last two have been with Disney. And, Disney has their own
Yeah, that's true.
In-house thing, but he has it. Well, to the point where at least Tenenbaums and Life Aquatic, they have their own single disc versions. I know Life Aquatic has a single disc version.
I still need to get the double one of that. I haven't gotten that yet.
And just to quick announcement, I got an email from Mr. Clark, and he is out of communication. But he said he's very sorry, and he will love to do it anytime after October 20th. And
okay.
So I've already emailed him and said we will more than glad have him on. I figured we'll have him on, and maybe during the holidays we can talk about holiday DVDs. Cause I know
we can talk about the Blade Runner DVD.
Oh, Blade Runner. Oh, definitely. He will probably have a lot to say. And the holiday DVDs, which is probably his craziest time of year. So
right.
See if we can get him then.
Well, we definitely look forward to having him on then. It's just been beyond anyone's control, these what's happened this evening, and we're glad to be on the air now, and we apologize for any inconvenience to our guests or listeners. So what are your favorite features on DVDs?
I got to go with I like nothing more than a good commentary. And what's interesting about commentary that I've learned is that some of your favorite directors might turn out to not be the best people for commentary.
Mm-hmm.
And even,
that's very true.
And some of your directors who you're kind of iffy on, or movies you're iffy on, they might turn out to create some of the best commentaries, period.
Yeah.
A good example of this contrast is like someone like Spike Lee, who's the Do the Right Thing commentary for the Criterion is fun because it's a lot of people, but whenever he goes solo, it's not the best commentary.
No, that's a good point.
Well, you know, some people lack the eloquence, and they said all that they needed to say with the actual movie.
That's another good point.
Yeah.
But there
are some people that are just completely entertaining in commentaries. The one that I appreciate most, and I agree with you, Aaron, the commentaries are my favorite part of the DVD special features as well. Oliver Stone. His
commentaries are some of the best overall, period.
They're sometimes better than the actual movie.
Yeah, I mean, they're just, I mean, commentaries on my favorite is probably Natural Born Killers. I just think that's a terrific commentary.
Mm.
The Doors is a great commentary.
Yeah, I like JFK. I mean, I like JFK anyway, but his commentary is so impassioned, and halfway through, he just gets
really gone.
He gets so worked up. You could hear him banging the table. He's like, damn it, this is our country.
Yeah, I mean,
I tell you, the two people who do commentary that I'm really taken aback by, that I really admire, and he's only done a couple. One is George Clooney.
Yeah,
he's done
good.
Two commentary. The Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, and then his Good Night and Good Luck commentary. Those are two great commentaries. I really look forward to his commentaries now. And the other great commentator is Steven Soderbergh.
Yeah.
Oh, he's the magnificent because he's so into the actual process.
Yeah. I mean, to the point, DVDs are worth picking up if he's doing a commentary, whether I need to pick up the new Graduate because I know he does one with Nichols that I'm dying to listen to.
And those are fantastic. And that's something you don't see enough of, the student and the teacher commentaries.
Right.
Because there's another one, Point Blank, the Frankenheimer.
Well, right.
Yeah,
Borman.
That's John
Borman, right.
And
with Soderbergh speaking with the editor of that film.
And he did Catch 22, fine commentary, and The Third Man on Criterion.
Oh, The Third Man is another one that Criterion called to my attention, you know.
Yeah, that's great. I had the one from, I guess, not the newest one. I had the one before that from Criterion.
And it's great to see them pristine and not on a 20-year-old videotape that you get from local store.
Any comments on, I guess, the two most prominent directors who do not do commentaries are De Palma and Spielberg. Do we have any feelings about that?
I have no problem with that. Because I think that's a case where their films do speak for themselves. And just judging from De Palma, we just did a whole show on him. He doesn't really like to be interviewed, and when he is interviewed, he can be cold.
Well, he doesn't like to talk about what his films mean.
Yeah.
Be a little grouchy. And the other, one guy even goes further who doesn't even do chapter stops, David Lynch. He won't do chapter stops on any of his movies. Let alone commentaries.
Yeah, and I mean, I can kind of understand that with a Lynch film because he wants the whole thing is its own experience.
Yeah,
can't remove one section from the whole thing. It's probably like a call for a certain kind of respect of his work. But you know, I can imagine what David Lynch would say in the commentary. You know,
see, that'd be a whole separate DVD.
Yeah, but in terms of Spielberg, I mean, I kind of don't understand it because he's interviewed so frequently, and he speaks so openly about his movies in other forums.
Yeah.
So I don't understand the.
Do you think maybe there's been so much written though about him, and so he is all over the place in one regard? Do you think that might be it?
Yeah, but a 20-year anniversary disc of E.T. I mean, what's the harm in sitting with your cast in a booth and recollecting?
I heard a story that, and I guess it didn't come to fruition, that at one point Lucas was doing commentary, I think, at contemplating for the Indiana Jones movies.
Right.
And Spielberg walked by and, like, apparently said, "Hey, we're recording. You want to talk?" And Spielberg said no. I have no idea if the story is true, so I don't want to be charged with libel.
Right,
I heard
right.
That story. Look, I just think it's kind of funny that Spielberg's like, "No, I don't want to be on it."
Has he ever said? I mean, does anyone know if there's any?
I think there is a quote. He says, "I like the film to speak for itself. I'll do the documentary."
Okay, that makes sense.
But yeah, the other good commentator, oddly enough, and whether filmed or good, bad, or indifferent, is actually William Friedkin,
mm-hmm.
who gives really good commentary. And
yeah, he's very energetic.
He is very energetic.
Does he have one for Bug?
Does he? I don't know if Bug has a commentary.
I've got Bug right here.
Let's find out. Let's go to the videotape.
I'm looking right now. A discussion with William Friedkin and audio commentary by director William Friedkin.
There you go.
That would be very interesting.
I still need to pick up. He's the only reason why I'm willing to pick up Cruising. Just I want to hear his commentary on Cruising.
That would be. I'm thinking about getting that.
Yeah. Do they put that in a brown paper bag when you buy it?
Well, you pick that up along with the 40th anniversary edition of Jungle Book. Like, I'll take Jungle Book and Cruising.
I was just going to pick that in Deliverance, but...
Wow.
That's the love two-pack.
Yeah, you know.
Wow. So we all love director commentaries and the documentaries and such. Is there an essential DVD or a couple of DVDs that you couldn't live without?
Ooh. I'll be honest with you. There are some I could... It just depends. I'll be very honest with you. I think I have, like, 200 DVDs that haven't even been opened yet.
Oh, really?
Really?
Oh, I try to go see everything if I really want to in the theater. To me, that's still the best way, even if it's, like, a rundown theater. I like the DVD, obviously. I mean, I'd be a richer person if I didn't like them, but I really would be. It's insane what I've accumulated since 1999. One job, I was just ridiculed because they could not believe the amount that I had. I mean, it was embarrassing. But is there a couple? And I got to say, you know, speaking of commentaries, they're the Kevin Smith films. Because his commentaries with his crew are hilarious.
Right.
Do you have that Clerks X DVD?
Yeah, I have the Clerks X, I have the Mallrats. I went back and got all, you know, double dipped or whatever you call it for all
apparently
those.
The Chase and Amy X is...
Yep, I know.
Chasing Amy, right.
That's a great Criterion disc.
It is.
The commentary for that is hysterical.
In fact, if you have the Laserdisc, and I think she's on the Criterion DVD, our guest, she actually makes a cameo in the deleted scenes.
Oh.
In the intros. I think Kevin brings someone on somewhat unwillingly. And so I think that's our guest. We'll have to ask her about that. For me... I think two off the top of my head. One, I can't do without, these are kind of odd, the Jonathan Demme DVD of Stop Making Sense.
Oh, that's a good, it's just a great film.
I just always, I watch that at least, you know, minimum. When I first got it, I was watching it every other day. Now I probably watch it at least five times a year. And another great DVD package came out by Image Entertainment last year. It's their four-disc special edition of the Taylor Hackford, Chuck Berry, Hail, Hail, Rock and Roll.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
That is just one of the best packages ever, I feel. It's kind of like it's Criterion level in its beauty.
Yeah.
So those two I'd probably go ahead. And it is true. It's these Criterion or it's these DVD boxes that you kind of do love. I mean, I wish I'd buy more, but they're so expensive.
They're very expensive.
Whether it's the Matrix, you know, Ultimate Matrix collection or the Batman anthology, you know,
or even the Ben Hur disc that came out a couple years ago. The four disc is a wonderful.
Well, even this latest Planet of the Apes that looked like it came in a Planet of the Apes head case.
Yeah, those are great. Those are great things, and there's great documentaries on those.
And
wonderful.
And those are the rare occasions. I like CDs that replaced LPs and DVDs that have replaced LaserDisc. I think the only thing that I can say I truly miss from LaserDisc, and it's the same thing I miss from LPs, is the packaging.
Right.
And DVD packaging is not what it used to be. It's only these rare occasions where they really can go out. You know, Anchor Bay does these wonderful Book of the Dead versions of the Evil Dead film.
I don't know,
those are kind of fun. And there's a Reanimator one that comes with a hypodermic needle. It's really a pin. And that's fun.
You know what's interesting, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you know how the CD era came in and you still to this day have people that swear by LPs over CDs because they sound better? There's nothing similar to that with video and DVD, is there?
Yeah, I would take a DVD over a tape probably any day of the week.
Sadly, we still in the business I'm in. We still work with people that send us VHS, and it's a pain to use. You know, it's just not fun.
Yeah, I mean the market really isn't supportive of, you know, that old VHS technology.
I mean, because tape is by definition it's analog.
Yeah.
Right? You know, and so it's just not digital, and so
that's
why I mean I kind of chuckle whenever I look at my DVR. One of the options is record to VHS. I really don't, you know, it kind of defeats the purpose.
Yeah. Gentlemen, our guest is on the line, which is very exciting. Can't wait to speak to this guest tonight. It's a true honor to welcome this guest to the show. The single most exciting benefit from this whole home entertainment explosion, for me personally, and I know for true movie fans the world over, has been the invaluable work of the Criterion Collection. As a result of their tireless efforts, cinema lovers have been introduced to some of the greatest landmark films from the world of international cinema, including previously unreleased gems from the likes of Kurosawa, Bergman, and Cassavetes. Our guest tonight is one of Criterion's most remarkable producers. Since the days of Laserdisc, she's nurtured a roster of extraordinary titles like The Blood of a Poet, Seven, Boogie Nights, Sid and Nancy, Trainspotting, Rushmore, Sisters, Notorious, and The Royal Tenenbaums, just to name a few. Her work can also be experienced in Criterion's upcoming release of the cult classic Tulane Blacktop. It's a great pleasure to welcome producer Susan Arstege to our program. Susan, are you there?
Hi.
Hi, thank you for calling in. We apologize for the inconvenience, the little technical glitch we suffered, but thank you so much for accommodating us.
No problem, and thank you for that super nice introduction. That was great.
It is our honor. You have been a part of some of the landmark LaserDisc and DVD experiences of all of us on the line here.
I'm happy to be talking to you guys. This is really nice.
Yeah, we have discussed between ourselves this opening of the show how much Criterion's work has truly enriched our lives. But tell me a little bit about you first. Tell me where your love of cinema began and what were some of your earliest cinematic influences?
Well, let's see. That's a good question, a tough question to answer. I started out in college. I'm from Boulder, Colorado. And I,
Go Boulder High School.
Exactly. Actually, I only went to college there. I didn't go to high school there. But I was working in a number of video stores at that time as well as record stores. And, you know, I was always into films and, you know, I think you guys were saying earlier the parts that I got to hear about, you know, the experience of renting VHS machines and watching movies that way. And, you know, we didn't have cable, so that was kind of the way, you know, I got to see a lot of films or whatever was on, you know, television and, you know, just going to the local grocery store and renting the, you know, the machine with the handle.
Right.
And whatever
yeah.
movies they happen to have in stock. And,
that's
you know,
right.
by college I got to, you know, it was great that I had the opportunity to work at so many good video stores. And one in particular that I worked at called the Video Station, which is still there
wow.
today. They
had a video station. Wow.
Yeah, yeah. And they had Criterion Laserdiscs.
Mm.
And I, you know, was able to watch a lot of the Criterion titles then. And I actually had a friend that worked at the company.
Wow.
From Boulder. He had delivered pizzas with one of the owner's sons for a summer. So Sean, that's Sean Anderson and Morgan Holly. And Sean, you know, got a summer internship at Criterion. He'd always go out to L.A. when the company was there and do three-month internships.
Mm.
And at a certain point when the company moved to New York, I, you know, Sean gave me a call and said, you know, you want to come out for the summer and, you know, do an internship. I was like, absolutely. I love Criterion. Are you kidding? That would be great.
Mm.
And, you know, that was in 1994, and I'm still there. So,
wow, so you've been
good, that's awesome. Good for you.
It must be a dream job.
It's great. I mean, it's one of, you know, it's the best group of people, and it's the most rewarding job, you know, I've ever had, and I consider myself very lucky.
So tell me exactly what you do as a producer there.
Well, the producer kind of oversees the entire, you know, all the entire project from, you know, there's a lot of people that work there and a lot of people that do, you know, different things, and it all starts with the film transfer.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we go around the world and try to find the best film elements that still exist and the correct version and, you know, make sure that we can make the best possible looking and sounding, you know, transfer that we can of the film.
But I'm curious on, obviously Criterion has released Laserdisc and DVDs of films that have
mm-hmm.
played recently in theaters. You know, Trainspotting is a good example. It played in theaters, and then around the time of its home video release, you know, Criterion had the Laserdisc. I'm curious about what is the process of going about getting an older title, and how does that start? I'm assuming, how does that start in, I guess, the conference room where, like, I guess you're throwing back ideas. How does that process start on one of the older films?
On one of the older films? Well, there's so many, you know, we have a lot, very good relationships with a lot of licensors from all over the world.
Right.
And it's more, we'll go out and buy sort of packages of films.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have so many films that we have the rights to that, you know, we just have titles and titles and titles to choose from.
Wow.
The studio titles are an interesting thing because those usually come up at the last minute.
Right.
And kind of the backbone of the collection is, you know, the Janus Films titles, since, you know, that's our sister company and
mm-hmm.
that's, you know, all the great classic foreign films. So we have, you know, tons of things to choose from there. And like I said, the studio things kind of get dropped in our lap. You know, we have relationships with certain studios and more have been opening up. You know, in the last few years we had our deal with Fox, and now we have a deal with Paramount. And, you know, that was unheard of in the laser days. They just didn't sub-license.
Mm-hmm.
Since Criterion does go all over the world to find the best element, what is the most, you know, what is one of the more memorable, one of the more memorable experiences where you had to go someplace to find, you know, a print or
mm-hmm.
a missing scene? Can
well, I might not get the specifics right on this because I didn't work on this project, but I remember Grand Illusion,
mm-hmm.
I believe it was Grand Illusion, and we had found a print that had been, you know, buried for years, and I can't remember. I shouldn't even speak to it, but it was a great story, and it had all to do with the war and everything. And I'm of course not going to remember it, so I'm not going to repeat it. But I know that was one. And you know, it kind of comes up all the time, where we'll just discover something, and all of a sudden, you know, we've got a fully restored version. And when we're lucky is when we're actually working with a living filmmaker
yeah.
or a cinematographer, when they can come
right.
in and supervise the look of the film and say, this is the way I've always wanted it to look, and we're able to accommodate that. That to us is like the biggest, you know, thing that we can do, is to have the person in the room, and they get to make all sorts of decisions and changes and things that maybe they weren't able to do when they made the film. So that's very satisfying.
I would imagine that you have, because like you've said, you've built tremendous relationships with certain filmmakers,
mm-hmm.
and when they're involved in the process, the results are just stunning.
Yeah.
But do filmmakers approach Criterion to handle their films? Because,
oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And one of those filmmakers is Wes Anderson.
Yeah.
I know you've produced several.
We were talking about, and we just, all of his films have been on Criterion, even though his last two films have been with the, you know, the Buena Vista Disney Corporation.
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming he's pretty much said, no, I want my stuff handled by Criterion.
Yeah, that's an interesting case. I mean, because when Rushmore came out, I believe he sort of, you know, got the ball rolling on that and said, you know, I really, because he's a big Criterion fan, and he really wanted his films to be in Criterion. And, you know, since Rushmore, he's kind of established that with, you know, whatever studio he works with, and says, you know, suggests, you know, can the film be in Criterion? And, you know, it's worked out in our favor so far. So it's very exciting.
Well, the news broke, I'm sure you heard, by MTV Movie Blog, of all places, that Criterion is working on Bottle Rocket.
Oh, yeah. Really? Okay.
You were supposed to say that, Aaron. Okay.
No, that's okay. Who's, did Wes break that news?
Yes, Wes confirmed with the writer of the MTV Movie Blog and said Criterion is working on it for 08.
Well, we certainly are. I'm very happy to say it finally came. It finally
right,
got to
awesome.
Us, and we're really, really happy to be doing it.
I guess I should leave it at that. I guess you probably couldn't tell us anything more, but I guess that we can leave.
Not
it.
Really. We're still in the early stages of production. I know there's a lot of deleted scenes that we're looking for, and of course the short film.
Oh yes.
No, that'll be excellent.
Yeah, it'll be great. And so I'm working with Wes is amazing because there's always so many fun ideas going around.
Oh,
so I'm sure there'll be something.
Let me ask you this: will the new Wes Anderson come directly to Criterion?
That I don't know.
Okay.
I
that has
really
a short
don't know.
Film on it. That has a short film that comes before that
yeah.
isn't going to be shown theatrically, but I read in the, I guess there's a review in the New York Times, and they said it will definitely be on the DVD.
Oh, yeah.
So we want all of Wes Anderson on Criterion.
Okay. You know, I think you can find that on YouTube.
Oh, yes.
And I think it might even be on
iTunes. It is on iTunes.
As well, yeah.
Okay, that's cool, but what? I want them all my Criterion.
Okay.
We love Criterion. What is the varying lengths of production for a disc? You say the more big studio films, you get those at the last minute. What about, obviously, the titles that are in the backlog and they're like, okay, we're going to start on it. What can be the production schedule on that?
Oh, it really varies. I mean, if there's a lot of, you know, detective work to be done or film elements to be found, the biggest time, you know, consuming thing is getting the right film elements. And if for some reason something's missing or doesn't look right, then, you know, that will take up a lot of time. I mean, if you know, Grand Illusion was Spy number one, but it came out, I think, sixth or seventh.
Right.
That was a case where, you know, we just waited and held the release. We'll do that. If we know that something's out there and we, you know, need to make it, you know, almost perfect, then we'll wait and, you know, put things off. But I would say probably 6 months from beginning to street date.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah, 3 months of that is authoring and, you know, check discs and going back and forth.
Right.
What was your most, I guess, arduous or most, you know, I guess, you know, rewarding disc that you worked on?
Well, rewarding and arduous are two different things. the one that took the most time was the Beastie Boys anthology.
Oh, I forgot about it. Yes.
Yeah, I was there. That I can see. Okay.
Yeah, that took a long time. That was probably a year and a half total.
Wow.
From beginning to end. Because, you know, they approached us to do it, and we worked out the deal with Capitol. And, you know, it was literally starting from a storage space and moving on. I mean, they brought in boxes and boxes of, you know, three-quarter tapes, VHS tapes.
Oh, God, all kinds of media.
Oh, my gosh, it was insane. So, you know, from all of that, we constructed all of those different video angles. And then we also had, you know, new DJs and new people come in and do remixes for all the different audio angles. So it was new content with old content with different angles. And that was really the most interesting because it really kind of pushed the limits of what the format could do.
Okay. I have a question for you about a future release in November, and I don't know if you worked on it, but how difficult was it to get Fassbinder's Berlin-Alexanderplatz?
I didn't actually work on that. I know from around the office that it was difficult, and we've been trying to get
it. That's 940 minutes.
Yeah.
It was for German television. I remember watching it on PBS long ago, but
That's going to be a big box set.
Yeah, it's going to be an astounding achievement, but how long did that take to get? That's a huge.
To license it or to actually work on it?
To get it, to work on it.
Oh,
it was enormous.
It was a while. That's been kicking around for a while, but
okay.
It's worth it. It's, you know, just the QC time on that alone is insane.
I would imagine.
I remember, a year and a half ago, they were holding fundraisers just to restore the theatrical print, let alone for home video consumption.
Yeah, absolutely. It's
one of those things.
So that, you know, that was absolutely a massive undertaking, but it's going to be very good.
And so is it true, because we said this at the top, is it true that you are on the Chase and Amy Laserdisc?
I am, and the DVD.
And the DVD. So,
okay, I'm going to have to go look at that.
No,
later.
Kevin brings you. What was?
I do remember this. I do remember this.
What was that like? Because obviously, once again, Disney and Miramax, they're pretty protective, and I think that I think that's the only Miramax film ever licensed to Criterion.
Now, Miramax, we had. That's where Trainspotting came from.
Oh, that's right.
And I believe Supercop came from them. And we also did that short-lived Rolling Thunder series, which was the Tarantino kind of offshoot.
Yeah, that he doesn't do that anymore.
And that was, what was it, Switchblade Sisters and Sonatine.
Switchblade Sisters, Curdled, and...
Yeah. We did Sonatine and Switchblade Sisters, but I think those were the only two we did in Rolling Thunder. So we
that?
Had that relationship with Miramax at that time, and that's...
That's how that happened.
Yeah, that's how that happened.
Well... Let's talk a little about this. The latest title you worked on is Tulane Blacktop. Because I'm curious, on what Criterion says when they're like, okay, we're going to do Tulane Blacktop. We got to create special features that are original and that have our print and that are not like anything on other versions of this film. Because I actually own, I guess from 6-7 years ago that. When Anchor Bay was trying to get into the business and they were doing those tin can editions.
Right.
And there's a Tulane Blacktop and it has a nice transfer and I think like an interview with Harry Dean Stanton, but that's about it. And they get you through the nose on because it's in a tin can. So So I'm curious on when Tulane Blacktop was like, okay, we have it, we're going to do it. What went into the process? Okay, what are we going to do feature-wise?
Well, we worked... I work very, closely with the director, Monty Hellman.
Wow.
And he, had tons of ideas. And, the Anchor Bay disc has been out of print for a while.
Right.
And, I had that disc, too, of course, and it's one of my favorite movies ever, so I was very excited. And, there was a commentary, and there was a...
The featurette, like an interview.
Yeah, it was a... I think it was a documentary on... It was pretty short, like 15 minutes on Monty and his career.
Right.
And there wasn't much else. So it actually, even though it was a special edition and it came in a tin can and with a keychain, but there wasn't really a lot of substance there.
Yeah.
So it wasn't too hard to, find people that want to talk about the movie because, when you start asking around, everybody says, oh, Tulane Blacktop, oh, so it was very easy to find people that were excited about it.
Mm-hmm.
And, we have commentary with the screenwriter, Rudy Wurlitzer, who's really an amazing person, and he came out and was interviewed by... David Meyer, an author and teacher here in New York, who actually is just finishing up a book on Graham Parsons. And he teaches a class on road movies. So he and Rudy sat and talked and, philosophized for a couple hours, and it's really pretty amazing commentary. And the other track is Monty Hellman and his friend Allison Anders, the director, who we just did her Border Radio as well. And
That was a good disc. That's
Oh, thank you. They had a great time, and it was really fun. That's kind of the more lighthearted commentary, and the Rudy and David one is, kind of heady. But other than that, Monty went out and interviewed, Kris Kristofferson.
Oh, cool.
Because, he basically gave Monty his song, Me and Bobby McGee, for the film. And he was actually up for the role, the James Taylor role. And they're old friends, so they talked for a half an hour. He also interviewed Michael Laughlin, who's the producer, and Walter Koblenz, who's the production manager, and his son, Jared, and his daughter, Melissa, is in there somewhere, because they were both in the film.
Mm.
They were young, but they were in the film.
Right.
What else is on there? Well, the big news is, on Friday, we did an interview with James Taylor.
Oh, wow.
Oh, awesome.
Yes, so that's...
I was going to ask you about because I guess he's the only one who's alive.
He is the only one
alive.
Of the main cast, besides Harry Dean. But
yeah, besides Harry, he's the only one alive from the main cast. I mean,
he had never really talked about the film before.
And he's amazing in the film.
And he's never seen it.
Right.
He's never seen it?
Never seen it.
Oh.
Wow.
Yeah, he's ready. Now he said he's ready. So I said, well, we'll make a good DVD for you. You can watch it.
Let me ask you this. Do you have plans to go back and do any other Hellman films, like Cockfighter or The Shooting?
Oh, I would love to. We're definitely looking into the rights for those.
Okay, cool.
I would love to. I mean, I think his movies are amazing. So
tell me when we can expect the release of Tulane Blacktop.
Tulane Blacktop comes out in December.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
I just had a couple of questions for you.
Mm-hmm.
One about a disc I believe you worked on, which was Sisters, De Palma's Sisters.
Yes.
We were speaking earlier how he's kind of notorious for not involving himself in commentaries and such. Did you have any collaboration with him at all in the preparation of that disc?
He's sort of, I can't remember now, but we did get his permission to use an interview. But I think it's the interview that's reprinted in the disc from the Village Voice, but he wasn't interested in doing a commentary.
Well, once again, I mean, that's we're all huge De Palma fans.
Yeah.
An essential early De Palma that I probably wouldn't have had any idea of without Criterion's contribution.
It's a great movie.
Yeah,
it very much is. Is there a film or a filmmaker that you'd most like to work with and produce a disc for?
Well, back in the day, I had the dream of, you know, doing a film with David Lynch or a project with David Lynch, but,
yeah.
You know, as you guys were saying, he just doesn't go there.
Right.
he's so controlling, he does it all himself.
Which is fine. I mean, yeah. I totally understand, and I understand how frustrating it is probably to some people that he doesn't put chapter stops in, but I totally understand, you know.
Yeah.
That's his thing.
The one director, I mean, if I can just suggest, and I always told myself, if I ever meet anyone from Criterion, I'm going to put in my suggestion, even though it might not even go up the food chain. And that is, because Criterion, you know, you put those spines together, you put them up, and it's all about the directors, and you just realize all the great directors represented. The one that I would love to see in the collection is actually John Sayles.
Yeah, we've definitely discussed that.
I mean, Baby It's You and City of Hope, I mean, these are films that are not even on DVD, you know, bare bones, and these are, I mean, truly remarkable.
Yeah, I mean, that could just be a rights problem, and I don't know specifically. You know, it's hard to approach it from that angle sometimes,
right?
Because then you'll spend all your time, you know, finding that one movie and trying to get the rights to that one movie.
What happens? I was always under the impression that the Criterion is the ultimate edition, but there's like a newer edition. I mean, do you lose the license, like for something like RoboCop?
Yeah, exactly. That was just a limited license.
Okay, no, because I would imagine I would always imagine the versions that come after the Criterion are always a step down.
Oh.
No, but I mean that from a film, just from a film lover's perspective and everything. I know they have some other bells and whistles on it, but the Criterion to me has always been like the definitive edition.
Well, thank you. We try. You know, the thing is with some of those, you know, they're studio titles, and they just, you know, for whatever reason, just wanted the rights back and wanted to do it themselves.
What I'm curious about, how does the idea come about to, like, you know, we're going to do a couple of commentaries on this film. Let's get a director who, you know, has nothing to do with the film, but get their perspective. I mean, Soderbergh on The Third Man, I mean, it's a good example that, you know, he has nothing to do with The Third Man, but, you know, obviously it's a no-brainer that he's probably a lover of The Third. So how does
absolutely well out? I mean, with Steven, you know, he's so into film and he's so smart, and the way he talks about it is just great. And, you know, The Third Man is one of these movies that's held in such high regard. It was really, you know, like you said, a no-brainer to get him to talk about it, because he's thought about it so much, and, you know, he just had The Good German come out, and that was very influenced by The Third Man.
Oh, that's right.
And, you know, actually, you know, he was, I think it was, had just come out when we were doing that commentary.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he wanted to do it with Tony Gilroy. I don't know if you guys have seen Michael Clayton yet.
It's probably should come out on Friday.
Yeah, I'm really excited to see it, because he was amazing, too. Mm-hmm. And just sort of the conversation between the two of them and how this movie shaped their, you know, filmmaking and writing was really interesting to listen to. And I think that's where it goes back to Criterion sort of being referred to as film school in a box, because you really can learn so much from listening to these people talk about it.
Oh, absolutely.
That's exactly what I find so valuable about it. What do you think Criterion's legacy is or will be?
That's a good question. I'd like to think it's a good one.
there's no doubt about that.
Yeah,
don't doubt that at all.
Well, I think, you know, I hope it, you know, makes people, you know, look at movies and appreciate them in a different way where they might not have before. You know, just getting used to seeing something letterboxed, I think, is a huge, huge thing in just, you know, consumer culture. You know, you look at television now and, you know, shows are letterboxed. They don't need to be.
Yeah.
You know, it's like they weren't shot to be shown in the theater, you know.
Right.
They should take up the full screen. But I guess that's also, you know, has to do with the 16:9 televisions and everything as well. But, you know, even before that sort of became the norm, you know, things were being letterboxed. And I think it just sort of changed the vocabulary of the way people expect to see things.
Right.
I mean, it is true. I was in the in a Barnes & Noble with my brother about 2 weeks ago. And I told him, they had their own separate display for Criterion. And I grabbed one, and he's my older brother, and I told him, I go, if you see any DVD with this symbol, the little C on it, buy it. I don't care what the title is. It could be the most obscure title that I don't even know the director. But chances are, you know, if Criterion puts their marking on it, then I want it. You know, they're like, okay, I'll just look for the
No, that's great. I mean, and that's we understand that, you know, that people really take a chance on us, and we appreciate that, and we you know want to be able to present things because we know you're taking a chance, and we know they're expensive, and we want you to be happy with what you get. You know, not all the films are going to be for everyone.
No,
you know, but
no,
it's
but
certainly...
they're usually just looking at the new releases. You know, Hellman, Bergman, Kurosawa, and they're not you know well-known titles, especially like The Drunken Angel from Kurosawa, which is a good movie.
Yeah,
very good movie. But it's good. And I have to say, one of the things that you've done, one of the directors that you've brought to light, and one of the most important, actually, especially for action fans, is the French director, Melville. His films are, you know, Le Samurai, The Red Circle, those Army of Shadows, which just came out.
Bobo Fumbo. I actually saw The Good Thief, the remake, and I went and bought Bobo Fumbo Sight Unseen.
Yeah, it's a wonderful Bob. It's just an awesome film.
Yeah. I mean, Melville's amazing.
Oh, he was he's a genius.
Yeah, and Army of Shadows is just so incredible.
And that's just that's a textbook example of Criterion truly presenting a director to mass to the mass audience because he'd obviously been around decades ago in revival houses and limited releases, but here he's probably gotten more viewers in the last couple of years than he ever had in his.
Yeah, John. When John Woo said he was influenced by Le Samurai, that pretty much opened the floodgates.
Absolutely, and that's why it's easy to find you know contemporary directors who would like to talk to these films.
Yeah,
because you know, especially like Linklater, you know, he started you know basically the Austin Film Society back in you know the mid '80s, and they were showing prints from Janus.
Yeah,
you know, and just getting their hands on whatever they could see, and that you know. Influence them to go on to make the way you know the movies the way they make them.
You and I must say, speaking of Linklater, I'm calling from San Antonio. You did remarkable work on both Slacker and Days of Confused.
Oh, absolutely.
Those are probably. I mean, to the point where I never bought a Days of Confused DVD because I knew Criterion someday or someone would put out a special.
Right.
That was that made me very happy.
I mean, I think
that's another one of my favorites, and it didn't. You know, from the day I started. We're saying we have to do that, you know, and it finally happened. So it was very.
But another director that Criterion has, I know you probably haven't, I know you didn't work on, but I mean, I think now more than ever, even in the 80s when they were starting to revive his career after his death, this Criterion pretty much single-handedly brought back John Cassavetes.
Oh yeah.
I mean, I love that box.
Yeah.
That box pretty much, I mean, that's Cassavetes in a box almost.
That was another big coup for us.
That's an incredible box set. I mean,
another giant. Yeah.
The Monterey Pop is another. Amazing, that's a whole week. You know, a historic weekend in rock music.
Yeah, absolutely.
Can you tell we're fans?
No, not at all. That's the thing.
Yeah.
You're expecting this buttoned-up professional interview, and we're just over here salivating.
Hardly.
I'll ask a semi-serious question, but it's kind of a geeky one. What is it like in the Criterion office, in that you walk in, and from what I've read, it's a pretty nondescript building. You wouldn't know it's Criterion if you walked past it. But I'm curious, what goes on? Is there a library where you know there are copies of the late? I mean, obviously all the Laserdiscs are out of print, but is there some kind of library where there's a Laserdisc copy of all their films?
Sort of. Unfortunately, as some of them have walked away over the years, we have a pretty complete Criterion collection, which is nice because, you know, you just can't find them anywhere.
Yeah.
But it's very, you know, we're in New York City, and it's, you know, you would walk by a million buildings and not really know what's in there. not like, you know, we're a storefront or something. You know, we're in a high rise and, you know, lots of people around. But it's incredibly laid back. I think you guys would be surprised. We're not very serious people. We can be very serious, but we also have a lot of fun.
Is there a screening room?
We have a screening room, and actually we're working on... We just moved into this new building about a year ago, and we built the whole thing out. So we have, you know, our individual QC rooms, audio rooms, editing rooms. So it's really nice because before we were kind of all on top of each other, you know, working out of closets and... You know, it was homey, but you know, it was a little cramped. But we're redoing our screening room now.
Was it a big deal when Criterion just recently, I guess a couple of weeks ago, finally decided to actually sell their product on their website?
It was a big deal. Yeah, we haven't done that since
the Laserdisc.
The Laserdisc days, and there weren't even websites then.
Right.
But that, what brought upon that?
I think it was all sort of about community building. I mean, we know that, you know, Criterion fans, you know, love to talk to each other and talk about the releases and that kind of thing. We really wanted to, you know, a lot of people have asked us to do that.
Yeah.
And it just seemed like the right idea. You know, we may not be the cheapest place to buy Criterion on the web, but it's also, we hope that the website can, you know, bring together some ideas and make suggestions and, you know, specials and offers based on, you know, things that we're thinking about or doing and, you know, just kind of bringing everybody together in one place because there's a lot of information on the website, actually.
I'm so geeky. At Christmas, I bought 2 shirts.
Oh, good. Well, that's the other thing. You know, people, you know, we wear them all the time. On any given day, there's 4 people wearing a Criterion or Janice shirt at the office. So
absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, Susan, you've been great to us for spending this amount of time with us and,
oh, of course.
And hearing us go on and on about your product.
No, it's very fun. I appreciate it. You guys are great. This show is awesome.
You guys do tremendously valuable work for film lovers
everywhere. We cannot wait. Obviously, we cannot wait for Tulane Blacktop and all the other films.
And Under the Volcano, too.
Oh, yeah, that's soon.
Absolutely. Now, were there any other requests you guys wanted to put in, or have we bothered to?
Go ahead.
I will put in, I know y'all did David Mamet with House of Games,
uh-huh.
And I am dying, because it's not even on DVD, I'm dying for Homicide.
Oh, that's a good one.
A David Mamet commentary on Homicide, I would...
Oh, you bet.
Okay, Jerry, how about you?
Oh, you know, I'm, you know, there's so much coming out. I'm gonna probably like trip over titles that they probably do have in the works.
Yeah.
But I'm gonna say, I'll just go with Kitano's like Fireworks or one of his films.
Okay.
Any of his films, I would love to see that, especially since Michael Jack has my copy of Fireworks. So, and I don't know if I'll ever get it back. You know,
let him know.
You know, Michael Jack, you know, from the guy, this is the great Kurosawa expert. He has my copy, so I'm just, if you guys made a new one, that would make it easier, so I don't have to get it back.
We'll at least tell him that you want your copy back.
Okay, thanks.
And mine would be, I think you guys did a Laserdisc of this years ago, Last Tango in Paris, do you recall?
God, did we? We might have. We did.
Yeah, that is a Laserdisc.
Yeah, you're right, we did.
It had the Pauline Kael review.
Well, that would be great, DVD.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
and
Danny would never leave his house ever again.
You could do an interview with Maria Schneider talking about how much she hates Bertolucci and Brando to this day.
Wow.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, I've got to see that.
Well, you know what? I actually wrote those down.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Oh, wow. Thanks.
Susan, thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure and an honor to speak
with
you.
Oh, thank you, guys. This was really fun. I appreciate it.
Thank you for coming
along. We hope we can have you back soon.
Absolutely. That'd be fun.
Criterion.
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. Well, you guys have a good night.
You
thank
too.
You.
And
thank
thanks
you.
Again.
Thank you
all
so
right,
much.
Take care.
Bye bye.
Bye bye.
That's Susan Arstege from.
That was my favorite interview so far.
Criterion Club. It's an absolutely geeky interview, isn't it? It's like
it was.
Okay.
It was a lot of fun. She was great.
Who here is excited the fact that A, not only did she write our suggestion down, but B, there is a distinct possibility, not that she owes us anything, that she might actually even pass it along.
Oh yeah,
I would. I think that's a very good chance of that.
It's going right to the top, guys.
It's going to the top.
If Peter Becker hears, we have some people who really want some sales and some another David Mamet disc. That's all I need. Even if Peter Becker says we can't do it.
You know, it's just essential. You can't talk about DVD without the Criterion Collection being part of that conversation.
Yeah, I mean they've made it so worthwhile. I mean.
And they've really elevated my – I've always loved movies, but they really elevated and broadened my appreciation of them. And I think that's the Criterion mission, to keep these films alive in the popular vernacular because they enrich our lives and enrich our appreciation of movies that mean more than typical,
and
you know.
Just what they do to some even older popular titles, like what I thought what they did with Spartacus was very good. And things like that. There are newer films, like when they did Traffic was wonderful.
Yeah.
And things like that. I mean, it's just wonderful additions.
And what a job. I mean, are we jealous of that job or what?
That would be the only job I'd really, like, look forward to going to every day.
A summer internship, not only in New York, but at the Criterion building. You don't have to pay me.
That's right.
Well, it's an internship. They're not going to pay you, okay?
Even if you hire me, you don't have to pay me. How many people here were not surprised that the Palmas, you're like, go ahead.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise. I mean, that's his personality. I mean, doesn't surprise, not at all.
We love De Palma.
De Palma, but dude, get involved.
We can't wait to get him on the show.
Yeah, we're getting him on the show, man.
You're gonna get him on the show.
We adore De Palma,
and
this film is a real like litmus test for his true fame.
It's not a litmus test, but look, this is gonna be the only place that he is going to be able to go for the rest of his life where he is not gonna be criticized. He's not gonna be crucified.
That's right.
This will be the friendliest interview he's ever done.
So first we're kissing up to Criterion, and now we're moving on to kissing up to De Palma.
Well, we kissed up to De Palma a couple months ago. He knows it.
I can't make fun of Mission to Mars.
No, Mission to Mars is an exceptional movie.
Okay.
Actually, Mission to Mars gets better, you know, I mean.
I think Mission to Mars is one of his most moving films.
I don't know, it gets 5 demerits because he uses a Van Halen song.
Oh, come on. That's actually that's one of the most positive or uplifting moments in any De Palma film.
Yeah, we talked at length about Mission to Mars, and it really shows a growth in a maturity that film does.
I think Femme Fatale was better with its maturity and its more...
Well, no, Femme Fatale is a very... is another one. It's a return to form, almost.
Yeah, it is. And I don't diss Black Dahlia like most people. It's an interesting film.
Okay.
All right, well, we've done with De Palma. Let's move on. Can we please move on?
De Palma was a few months ago.
Well, yeah, here's a question.
Yeah.
Okay, we all can agree Criterion is the gold standard.
Yeah.
What about what other studio that are you all aware of, or you know, non-Criterion DVDs that you all think, wow, they did Criterion like work? I can name one studio that is the equivalent of Criterion.
Which one's that?
And that is, believe it or not, Warner Brothers.
Now he's absolutely right on this.
Yeah, Warner Brothers has the one of their new series that they've introduced. With a lot of their classic films.
Like what they did, Treasure Sierra Madre and Robin Hood.
Yeah, they're two- and three-disc DVD sets.
You know, even a, you know, a B-film or a B-noir will at the very least get a film noir commentary.
Oh, well, those box sets are wonderful. They have Out of the Past. And
a featurette.
Yeah, those are great.
Warner's is they do, it's almost as if they looked at Criterion's playbook and said, okay, we're going to do that here. It's probably why Warner's is probably, I think, one of the few studios that does not license the Criterion, and it's one of the few studios that's like, okay, they don't have to license. I trust them.
Absolutely.
No, that's a good point. The other one to be on the lookout for, and we were talking about John Woo, but I think it is the Weinstein Company owns Dragon Dynasty. I'm not sure, and they're putting out these Hong Kong films in really elaborate, very nice editions that are like two disc editions that are very nice.
And can we all agree on some of the worst studios that? They have great catalogs, but they are treating their films like shit. I nominate Paramount.
Paramount. Well, they're having so much trouble. I mean,
yeah.
If it ain't Star Trek or Friday the 13th, they're not really lavishing.
Wasn't DreamWorks late in the game too? Weren't they one of the last studios?
Yeah, they're pretty late, and so their stuff is still hit and miss. I mean, I do have hope now that Ms. Arcegi said that. They now have conversations with Paramount.
Yeah.
We'll see what happens.
Great. Didn't they come out with it? Didn't they come out with the conversation?
The special edition
DVD of that.
You know,
I have a conversation from like the first, I guess, DVD.
You know, conversation and the, you know, they could not lavish. They could not do something important for like The Godfather.
Right.
They just weren't gonna do it. But I mean, I'm just talking, you know, catalog, you know, regular Paramount. Film. Well,
I honestly don't know if there's anything more to be mined from The Godfather. I mean,
isn't there a new prince coming out next year?
It's a pretty expansive box set of The Godfather already available.
It's a great, but I mean, there is something new coming out next year.
Yeah.
Though.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll look after that.
Okay.
We've talked about DVD, but we've been avoiding something that's right on the horizon.
The elephant in the room.
Our next guest is on the line and ready to go. Of course, technology moves at a rapid pace. 10 years after the oncoming of the DVD revolution, new formats are already beginning to gain major momentum. I'm sure everyone's heard of the emerging format war between HD DVD and Blu-ray, but Like me, I'm sure most of you are wondering what's the difference, which one will win out, and how much better can the quality really be over traditional DVD. Here to answer all these questions and much more is the esteemed entertainment reporter from USA Today, who covers digital entertainment for the Life section and is a regular contributor to Tuesday's digital download feature. It's a pleasure to welcome Mr. Mike Snyder to our program. Mike, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for your patience and for accommodating our little glitch earlier this evening.
How's the football going? Who's ahead? Philadelphia?
You know, actually, I've been doing a little research, so I don't know. I think it's 0-0. I'm just basking in the glow of a Chiefs victory. So, I don't hope you don't mind. I've got a Sierra Nevada here, and I'm dying to talk with you.
Whatever makes you feel at home, you know? You're not the only one.
I have an Aqua Velva.
I'm excited to learn about these new formats. But first of all, tell me a little bit about yourself. Were you always interested in technology?
Well, yeah, I was. I mean, I grew up reading Stereo Review. You know, I didn't always have the money to buy what I wanted, but I'm always interested in what, you know, the cutting edge or state of the art audio and video was.
Right.
I think I really was more into music initially, but I've always loved movies and spent a lot of time at movie theaters as a kid, and just kind of, I guess, made my way into the reporting world when I got off the train from being an English teacher. So.
Oh wow.
So I took my first job, kind of became, you know, did a lot of years of police reporting and, you know, whatever is needed to be done, local politics, city hall, and then came to USA Today as a medical reporter 17 years ago. And a year or so later, someone who was going to go to the CES show couldn't go. I can't remember if they were sick or had a conflict, and I said, hey, I'd love to go.
Electronics.
This is the thing in Vegas, right?
At this time, they also had a summer one in Chicago.
Oh, okay.
That tells you how long ago it was. It was quite a while. I'm 44, so that was about 13 years ago. And I was amazed by, you know, big TVs at that time, big tube TVs and things like that, and have gone to pretty much every CES since then. And I also picked up a beat along the way of covering video games, and then picked up another beat of covering online when, you know, people started buying PCs and getting on the internet, and things like America Online and Prodigy were around.
Sure,
and
wow.
then I got to cover the creation of the DVD standard, and that kind of took care of me for, you know, 12 years, you know, following the fights over DVD, and of course the good thing for consumers was that there was an agreed upon standard, and all the studios decided to put out to support one format, and that's really what helped DVD become so successful, in my opinion. I think most people would agree to that.
Is that everyone got behind it?
Yeah. And so I've covered DVD for quite a while. I've kind of gotten away from writing about individual DVDs because they've kind of become cookie cutter, not as exciting to my editors.
Mm-hmm.
So I do a lot of games and digital, that's why we call it the digital download, what's coming online, movies for one thing.
Right.
And then I continue to follow high def video and write about that every month or so about what's happening there. So, and it's not playing out the way people wanted it to. And I don't know when you want to get into that, but
before we get into the HD versus Blu-ray, I got to ask, because you brought up video games, have you played Halo 3?
Unfortunately, I've only played 3 hours of it.
Oh.
I have played it. I saw the online beta back in May, and then one of the guys from Bungie and a couple Microsoft people came to my office a month ago, and I got to, you know, see about an hour and a half worth. And then I played some here at home by myself. I'm not quite ready to go online and play. That's not kind of the way. I'm more of a single player guy, but
me too.
It looks great. I mean, I think it's one of those few things that delivers on the hype.
Yeah.
Oh,
and I never felt, I didn't feel bad writing about it. Let's put it that way. I mean, I would have written more about it.
it's difficult to maintain a life outside of your living room whenever you
those
video games, isn't it?
It is. I mean, in fact, I write about them more than I play them. I mean, a hot game is coming along. I get to spend a little bit of time about with it before, and then I kind of got to go on to the cell phone game story or the movie download story or
the
website story or whatever.
You know, something that we haven't discussed yet about the DVD format before we get into the new formats is how it's not only revolutionized the home movie watching experience, but how it's kind of given the film industry in general a whole new outlet of revenue.
Oh, yeah.
Sometimes
They're living on these things.
In excess of theatrical,
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you see the window shrinking, you know, between theatrical release and DVD release.
Was it like 3 months now?
Would you consider that a double-edged sword? Because
yes,
we would all agree that theatrical is the best thing, but obviously windows are shrinking, and I assume that some directors with more clout, like a Spielberg or something, I would assume privately they're trying to fight against that shrinking window. Has that occurred on this beat, or?
Well, the reverse in the case of George Lucas. I don't know much about what Steven Spielberg wants to do, but I think he'd be able to kind of, you know, bend it the way he wants to. But I think someone like George Lucas, you know, if his movie, you know, couldn't be shown in a theater the way he wants it, I think he wouldn't have a problem with it being sent, you know, to homes digitally right away.
But
he hasn't told me that, but I mean,
he has such a thing with piracy, though, that one of the things he had to get, like, the Star Wars prequel thing done as soon as possible, because he said if I waited any longer, it would just be people would just take it immediately and put it online.
Yeah.
And he was very worried when the last film came out. That was, like, his thing was, look, you're not going to be able to have these in the theaters much longer, because they're just, everyone's getting them online illegally, and he was the big thing about that. But I think you're right, though. If he would, if it wasn't shown the way he wanted it, he would just, he would make his own pain.
And I think that's one of the good sides of the shrinking window is that if you don't have a place that is a good venue to watch a movie, you'd rather watch it at home.
I
would love to see every movie in a theater. I'd really prefer to see it in, you know, a classic theater like in D.C., the Uptown, or in Baltimore, the Senator. But I can't always get there. And I can get there, I may not always get a ticket. And a stadium, you know, our new stadium theater here is good, but a full theater of a movie like, well, I don't want to say the Bourne movie because people were pretty polite at that movie. But sometimes you get a movie where it's not going to be a quiet scene, you know. So
right.
You're right. There is a double-edged sword here because, you know, you want to be able to preserve the movie experience, and you don't want it to become just a treadmill of product. Which can be depressing to people probably like me and you.
Mm-hmm.
Would you say that one of the key things that studios and consumers that should be, and people who cover this beat should be looking out is when Cameron puts out his 3D film nationally in theater? Is that going to be something that's really going to be scrutinized on possibly new ways of enticing people back into theaters?
Well, I know that's what they hope will happen. I don't know. I mean, I probably would want to go, but I don't know that my wife wants to go.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I know that a lot of people are looking at 3D as a way to get people back in the theater. But, you know, there's another way to get people back in the theater. Make good movies.
That's exactly
absolutely
right.
I mean, I would love to see what James Cameron's going to do. But, depending on how long it's there, and, you know,
that's
extenuating circumstances, I don't know that I can get there. Everybody can't get to a 3D theater, and, you know, they're finding this idea of digital projection, you know, it isn't happening as fast as, you know, some people would want it to happen, and 3D is, you know, is a deployment issue, too. I mean, everybody doesn't have the equipment needed. I haven't written about this. My colleague Susan Wazena has. If somebody's listening and wants to, you know, go on to usatoday.com, they can find her index, and she's written about it, fairly recently.
You know what I think they should do? I think they should bring back Smell-O-Vision.
I don't know. Now, maybe for, like, Water for Chocolate, but, I don't know if I want Smell-O-Vision for zombie movies.
Can you imagine Borat in Smell-O-Vision?
Oh, God. Well, that would be
no,
hell if he had
I can imagine it. As Han Solo would say, I can imagine quite a bit.
Yeah. That's right.
All right, so let's get to this HD, DVD, and Blu-ray format war.
When did they start? When were there rumblings about it, and then when did they first started coming into the market? If I remember correctly, they started coming in the last quarter of last year is when they really.
The rumblings, I don't actually remember when the first rumblings came out, but I mean, as soon as you know the scientists got done with DVD, I'm sure they started thinking about the next thing. But HD DVD came to market in April of 2006, and Blu-ray came out in June.
Mm-hmm.
Just for one thing, one other data point I'll throw out since we were talking about DVD earlier and how much money studios make. They made $16.6 billion on DVD sales last year, and I think like another $7 billion or so on rentals. And that's a little bit higher than in 2005, but I think box office was only like $10 billion or something like
that.
Wow. So, I mean,
twice as much.
Yeah, so they're really living off of DVD, and what is so interesting about this is that they really need a new cash cow, and they couldn't agree on the delivery method. And right now, neither of these formats are doing very well. They're kind of floundering. There are people that, if you're a video game person and you want a Sony PlayStation 3, you could play Blu-ray movies. If you're an Xbox,
almost a de facto Blu-ray participant just because of the game console.
Right, right. And I don't know if most people understand this, and I don't claim to have insider knowledge, but the reason why there are two formats is because if you create the format, you make money by licensing all the various processes in the format for manufacturing and
mm-hmm.
having your disc made or whatever. But there are two formats. One's called HD DVD, and it is kind of led by Toshiba and initially Microsoft, and we kind of don't really know how strong Microsoft is in there on that. But so we have films from, let's see here, let me make sure I get this right. I should have listed this down for you. The only studio that only puts out films on HD DVD is Universal.
Okay.
And then a studio like Warner puts out movies on both formats, HD, DVD, and Blu-ray. The big hubbub recently was that Paramount and DreamWorks shifted sides over to the HD, DVD side.
That's right.
So then you have Blu-ray, which the technology company, the main technology company is Sony, and their new PlayStation 3 games are Blu-ray discs, and so their studio is... supports only Blu-ray,
right.
And so does Fox. And then Warner will put out films on that format also.
And plus you have the retailers as well. I noticed Blockbuster has gone with Blu-ray.
Right, right. That happened a couple months ago, and I don't know if that's officially implemented yet, but they've said they're going to do that.
Yeah.
Is
Netflix both, or are they not in the game?
No, I'll be honest with you. I don't remember. I think Netflix does both, but we can check that out while we're... talking.
And what about Disney?
Disney is a Blu-ray. Yeah.
Okay.
So is there a noticeable difference between these formats and regular DVD and these two formats between each other?
Well, this is where you get very subjective.
Yeah.
Because this happens in a lot of video. I mean, some people will say, there's a few people out there say, I'm not going to get a DVD player because I don't see the difference. Now, there's not that many that do that now, and it's so cheap that it's kind of they have to because there's no
Netflix
way everything.
Netflix does both.
What's that?
Netflix does have both HD and Blu-ray.
Okay.
So then we get to HD TV, you know, 4 to 5 times the video quality. I mean, there's a lot of semantics used in here and a lot of calculations of pixels and things that I'm not going to get to, but I mean, it's tech, you know, scientifically it should look better, and to most people's eyes, I think it does look better. To some people's eyes, just like some people can't smell everything and are colorblind, they may not be able to, they say it looks the same to me. You know, I'll tell you, as someone who has to watch a lot of DVDs and watch a lot of HD, my eye is used to HD now. So I really prefer to watch a movie on a high-def disc.
There's somebody out there probably still going, you know what, 8-track is still sounding pretty good.
There's always a contrarian, you know. Yeah. But the problem is, since this is so subjective, what gets a consumer to convert? Mm-hmm. So let me go back to what you said. Is there a difference between these two? I don't really, from what when I watch them, I don't really see a difference. I mean, I might mentally say the Blu-ray should look better, so I bet it looks better, because technically it is able to hold more data.
Okay.
So technically it's supposed to be a superior format, and when this started last year, most people put their money on Blu-ray to win this, because it was technologically a better format. And if people want to, you know, look at the stats and everything, if they go on, you know, to Google, they can find the HD DVD, .org will have all the information on that, and Blu-rayDisc.com will have all the information about Blu-ray. But they're about the same. Okay. To the average person. They're not compatible.
Isn't it all a moot point until HDTV ownership is the norm?
Well, it is, but for some people that is the norm. In fact, about 30% of homes have an HD set now, so that's about 1 in 3. And supposedly, by the end of this year, there'll be 52 million or more homes that have them. So that gets you up to 36%. So that's better than 1 out of 3 homes will have an HD TV.
Well, yeah. Also, isn't it FCC has, they keep moving the date, but supposedly by 2010, there'll be no more...
February something 2009. I don't have that date in front of me.
Where, you know, all TV signals are going to be digital.
Yeah, right. That's right.
And so what I'm curious... I'm curious, obviously people put their money on Blu-ray because it's supposed to be superior quality, but also, wasn't it kind of Sony was kind of, it was kind of a brilliant masterstroke in that Blu-ray was built into PlayStation 3,
uh-huh.
In that pretty much every PlayStation 3 sold can also be counted as a Blu-ray disc player sold.
Certainly, case. Yeah, and the problem in that plan was the PlayStation 3 is not sold as well as all the analysts thought.
Right.
It is technologically... And I think it was the Perfect Vision magazine. I'm sure some of you guys and your listeners are familiar with that magazine.
Right.
Basically called it at the time the best Blu-ray player. And it was at the time the cheapest Blu-ray player. So the problem is there just hasn't been enough hot games to get a video game person to convert. And once that video game person converts to a PlayStation 3, the theory is that when they go buy a video game, they're going to buy a movie. Because they're going to want to watch it on their new machine. So
is this similar? We were talking about this at the very beginning of the show, that when in the 80s and early 90s, when it was home video cassette, and LaserDisc, and that LaserDisc was a niche, and home video was mass market. And then DVD came, and it combined the best of both worlds, and it turned everyone into a movie geek, more or less, whether they wanted to be or not. We're now with these HD... DVD versus Blu-ray, this is more, it's more equating to niche. It's like DVD is what cassette used to be 25 years ago, and this HD versus Blu-ray, that's kind of like the LaserDisc crowd, the tech crowd, where it's more about the niche, and it's never going to be on that mass appeal that a regular DVD is. Is that a
Well, you're at the moment, I think you're right, but I think what each of the sides would say is, this is a long haul, and eventually when our format wins, it will become the replacement and the mass, and it will move from a niche to a mass medium. Because at some point, they'll quit making DVD, possibly, or a studio will say, well, look, we're going to put it all out on our high-def format.
Do you really think a studio will... do that? I mean, I would...
It could be... No, that's going to be fine. That could be 5 or 10 years away, I would think. But, I mean, someday, you would think they would do that, wouldn't you? I mean...
I would think they stock... I mean, there's just... I mean, I'm not in the expert. I would just think stockholders are just too nervous. They're like, you know what, we're not...
That's a long way away. And look, I appreciate you guys calling me expert, but I'm just guys like you. I mean, I'm into this, and I just get paid to ask people questions and try to write stories about it.
Right. You're doing a very good job, though. So
Here's a good question. What significance is being put on, or is there significance on this upcoming holiday season?
Well, a story I put together recently, and I kind of picked a lot of people's brains about, is that they're trying to say it's important, but they're also trying to have their cake and eat it too, in that they're saying, but this is a long haul. I mean, there is no one thing, one release, or two releases that either format has that's going to make a consumer make a choice. If they're not ready to make a choice now, Spider-Man, they don't think, the experts I talk to, don't think that's going to be enough to throw somebody over. Now, I think if there's somebody, there's a lot of things happening here. There's a video game that was going to come out, Grand Theft Auto 4. If that had come out on PlayStation 3 and Xbox 360, that might have spurred on people to buy new game systems. Mm-hmm. And that might have spurred somebody to say, you know, if I can get Grand Theft Auto 4 and Spider-Man 1, 2, and 3 in high def, this sounds like a pretty good time to do this.
Right.
Has Grand Theft Auto 4 been postponed?
It's been postponed until, I think, next spring. They don't have an exact date yet.
Oh,
so.
Wow.
I guess I'm kind of talking around the question. I don't think this Christmas is a time for one to win. However, it's a time for one to either gain ground or lose ground.
Yeah.
Let me read a couple of data points from some research that came out, let's see, was it last week? No, it was the week before, September 21st, from Forrester Research, some people I talk to a lot on various topics in digital entertainment, and they had bet on Blu-ray back in 2005, and the way that things have gone out now, they've said this format was going to continue for at least 18 more months.
Wow.
And the reason they say that is because Blu-ray hasn't caught fire enough to knock HD DVD out of the marketplace. Let me throw a couple real world data points in here, in that, let's see here. So far this year, Blu-ray movie discs, movies on Blu-ray discs have outsold HD DVD 2-1.
Hmm.
Now, we're only talking, you know, a few millions millions of discs, whereas, you know, DVDs are in the hundreds of millions.
Right.
And let's see here. Another research firm thinks that PlayStation 3 will still be the most popular high-def disc player this year, selling about 3 million. So, you know, that's one-tenth of how many DVD players were bought last year. So we're still talking about a fledgling market. But what Forrester says Blu-ray could do to jumpstart things and what could change that theory of an 18-month format war is if they would cut price. And if the PlayStation 3 would drop and they could get their players, what they're saying is they need to get a player out there for $250 or less by Christmas. Now, I haven't seen anything that says that's going to happen, but, you know, so...
That's something that these manufacturers, these companies could do, but they are choosing not to, or is it not in their best interest to even go that low in price yet because the cost of production is still not at a point where they could do a price that low?
Well, I'll be honest with you. I don't know the economics of the whole thing. I will say that this is not going the way any of these companies want it. I mean, the idea of having a step-up format, a high-def format for home video, is to increase the margins on the hardware and the software, because
mm-hmm.
DVD players are commodities now, and so are DVDs. I mean, we could buy a new DVD sometimes for under $15, maybe $10, depending on where you shop. They're not making that much money off of those. You know, so if you could sell a high-def disc for $25 or $30 and a player, you know, for at this time in the DVD format evolution, I don't think you could get the player for under $500 still. They're pricing the HD DVD players are under $500 now.
Hmm.
That's why Forrester says Blu-ray needs to get one lower. It may not may not be a Sony branded machine. Maybe, you know, a knockoff company or someone else could put one out. So this is not going the way anybody wanted it to, and so the economics have become almost philosophical. I mean, it's like how we want to win at all costs, and so it's really a weird situation.
What's also interesting is that when DVD came out, it started off, you know, like any format, people were hesitant, but there was that one title, The Matrix, which is one title where first film to sell a million units, and people could really see the benefits and how great DVD could be. But it seems in the little over a year of these two formats, and some of these titles have been put out on HD and Blu-ray, like The Matrix box, but it seems like there hasn't been a title that to mobilize either format. Is that fair?
I'm doing a search here. I forget what the data was, but the biggest, I think one of the big things that Sony touted out was Casino Royale, and I'm trying to get the numbers
and
on that.
Also 300. Wasn't 300 another?
And then Warner mentioned 300. Let's see here. Somebody else want to search? I assume somebody else there has a computer going. If you search 300, I'll search Casino Royale. I mean, we're in Departed. I mean, they're only in the hundreds of thousands. I don't think anybody's gotten to a million on one of these. But the thought might be that Spider-Man 3 could be one. It could be a movie like that. Or Pirates.
Yeah, Pirates movies, I would imagine.
Because, I mean, do any of you guys have... I mean, I'll say that I agree that the high def discs look great. The problem is I'm not a paying customer. I mean, I get to test them and play with them. You know, I don't know if I would go out and pay for this if I was. Any of you guys have one?
No,
we have an HD screen, but not a. I don't have it. The players though.
Mm-hmm.
The disc.
I have the HD. You know, 50-inch TV, and
right.
I stick with the DVD just because the price is still good and.
Mm-hmm.
The picture is top quality as DVD go.
Right.
I mean, the margin of improvement to me is not worth the upgrade because these HD DVDs and these Blu-ray discs, they're selling. Oh, here's the ironic thing: they're selling a regular HD DVD with not many extras. They're just the film, or a Blu-ray disc with not many extras. They're just the film. Are selling for what a top line Criterion DVD costs.
Right.
You know,
right.
They're selling
yeah.
for $40. You know, I can pay that for Criterion, and I can get two discs with a whole bunch of bells and whistles.
Right, right. Yeah.
That's
part of the problem here. I mean, that's part of the problem. When you have movie fans that are saying, we're not ready for this, because, and now we don't know whether you might have been ready for it if there was one format, and
I think movie fans... would have been more open to if it had just been, let's say, HD DVD. And it's better quality,
right.
better picture, and we're gonna get the selling point would have been, you know what, all those features that go on disc 2 and 3, we're now gonna fit them just on one disc.
Mm-hmm.
That would have been, I think, a key selling point just to like the movie game.
Right.
Yeah.
As of August,
that hasn't happened.
300 sales figures they had in the first week, it sold 250 copies. That's according to Warner Home Video, the first
250?
250,000 copies.
Okay. Thousands, okay.
Yeah.
I don't think we've had one hit a million yet. I think I'd remember that. So.
And it's coming up almost on a two-year anniversary, and it took about 18 months, I guess, for Matrix to 2 years for Matrix to really spike the market.
So either way, it's going to be a slow process, and they're going to need to nurture these formats during this process to see which one will win out. But what does your gut tell you, or is there just not enough information at this point to tell?
Well, I kind of agree with Forrester. I don't see Sony losing this.
Right.
Mainly because they've done so well with PlayStation 1 and 2. Now, this is a whole other ball game when you try to make your video game system, you know, tied into the home video format. But if Disney and Sony stay solid, and Fox. I mean, you're going to have one format, a single format come into being, you're going to need those three companies.
Right.
Yeah.
So if they stay solid and don't move, I don't see them losing. I see us having, if we either everybody else caves eventually, or we have this fragmented thing that eventually everybody just buys their, when you asked me to come on, you asked me to talk about what other things might happen, potential just become internet downloads or cable demand. I mean, it just isn't a packaged media anymore.
And wouldn't a studio, I'm just curious, a studio like Fox, while they're on the Blu-ray side, aren't they going to be a little nervous? Because, yes, it's Fox, but people like George Lucas and James Cameron, who's catalogs are probably the biggest, some of the biggest assets on this war, but those directors I would think have the right, they can pick either format they want, even if Fox is totally Blu-ray. I would think if George Lucas says, you know what, I prefer HD, I don't care what you have, that's what I'm releasing. I mean, is that even something that would...
Well, that's when you begin to Your foothold on the tug of war begins to loosen. I mean, if a Star Wars, you know, comes out on one format and not the other, I mean, that's a big blow.
Yeah.
And it just shows, you know, that you don't have you're not a solid team anymore. And, you know, that's what happened to Blu-ray recently, not in a director situation, but in in a couple studios going to the other side. Now, it was supposedly because of money, but, I mean, that's all fair in a format war. I mean, there's nothing illegal. But
right.
Say, look, we'll give you some money if you come over here for a while and we do your movies this way. So,
because, I mean, Paramount leaving Blu-ray, I mean, pretty much they just took all their Star Trek properties. I'm assuming that's probably a big loss for Blu-ray, that the Star Trek is not going to be Blu-ray. It's just going to be HD.
Right, and... Mm-hmm. And the big thing this fall will be the Transformers film.
Right.
Right.
That's next month, correct?
Yeah. Let's see. I forget what date.
Yeah, I think that's October 16th that comes out.
So there'll be some interesting gauges of popularity with that film, with Spider-Man, with Pirates coming out. See, and then... where's my list here? Warner has some pretty interesting stuff coming out.
Well, I mean, this Blade Runner thing is
really
somewhat... I mean, granted, Blade Runner is not a Star Wars...
Blade Runner...
But Blade Runner, as coming out in all these formats, is probably going to be interesting to see how
It's one of those. It's one of those discs. It's a show-off disc.
Yeah.
I mean, you assume it's going to look like a show-off disc. Otherwise, why put it out again? I mean, it's supposed to be. I haven't seen a final version of it, but it's supposed to should look a lot better. So that would be it could be something important. Though I mean, it's not going to get. I don't know that it'll get young people to buy it, but I mean, people my age.
Yeah, I'll buy it. I mean,
yeah, young people tend to have a short memory span.
They might be interested just because they keep hearing. I hear Children of Men is the best film since Blade Runner. So
That's right. Well, it'll be really interesting to see how this plays out. And Mr. Snyder, come back to our program anytime you'd like to keep us abreast of all these developments in this format.
Well, it's been fun. It's fun listening to. I didn't get on to listen to Mike because
he didn't. He actually couldn't.
He couldn't.
He couldn't reschedule. So we're bringing him back in sometime later on in October. But
Susan was good to talk to. I actually got to go to Criterion a year or two ago and did kind of the film school in a box story. Paper, so it was great. Yeah, I mean, it was great to have to sit and watch these 10 great films and write about them. So,
oh goodness, that must have been quite an experience. So you actually went into the secretive.
Yeah, right off a street in Manhattan. I don't actually remember where it was. I'm sure I have the email that would tell me where it was. But
I don't
just
think
looked like
to give that out.
Yeah, it looked like. It just looked like any other street any other street you just walk on in New York, and you go in this little door and you go up the stairs and there's Peter Becker and everybody. So
wow.
It was fun.
That's movie geek heaven right there.
Yeah.
Well, that's the fun part of the job, you know, getting to do stuff like that, getting to see, I got to go see the Star Wars films when they were remastered in high def before they came out and see, you know, the before and afters, and the same with the James Bond when they remastered them for the last
Could
DVD
you tell
release.
A difference? Speak, I mean, since
Oh, yes. For either of them, yeah. Wow. Oh yeah, there's quite a difference. I mean, they've mastered them for high def. They're all ready for high def. It's just you know, when's there a format or, well, Star Wars has been on high def on TV.
Yes.
Is it HDNet 2? See, I don't have Cinemax, but I have them recorded on my.
Yeah, but it's like the Cinemax and HBO, they have the HD channels. Yeah,
So. Anyway.
All right, Mr.
So that's the fun part, but it's great talking to you guys, too, and you're doing a good job. So.
Thank you so much, sir.
We appreciate having you on.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
That is Mike Snyder with USA Today telling us all about this Blu-ray HD DVD. Okay, I understand it a little bit better now.
I understand it, but I just don't know where it's going to go. I mean,
well, no one can really know where it's going to go. I just wanted some kind of elementary understanding of what we're looking at, because...
Oh. Are we all in agreement that we're going to just stick to DVD, though?
Yeah.
I'm like my Laserdisc now. You know, with my Laserdisc, I absolutely refused to purchase DVD for such a long time. But, you know, I'm with those DVDs now.
He brought up a good point, though, in passing, and it is about the digital downloads, the on-demand.
Yeah.
When that becomes so prevalent, when does that affect, you know, why go... Now, I like to own, like, certain movies and everything, but for the average person, well, I can just, you know, call up my cable company or just send an email to my cable company or just download it from Netflix. You can do that now. You can download movies from Netflix.
Yeah, iTunes.
Where, you know, that's a big factor, too, to take into consideration in a couple of years.
Yeah, how's the quality? I mean, does it look like you're wearing a pantyhose?
It looks like, I mean, the quality, I haven't done it. For Netflix, I don't really want to because it takes a long time. Also, that's another.
I think
thing.
That's the thing about it's one thing to download like a 15-minute film, like maybe this Wes Anderson film, but an actual 2-hour film, you got to download it and then like you know come back in an hour. I don't think we're even.
And you also have to have the storage too on your hard drive.
Even
that's a lot of gigs.
Yeah, this wireless, you know, wireless is great and it's you know it's super fast, not like dial up, but I think we're still a long way of having, you know, truly. High speed where you can download a movie in 10 minutes.
Not happening.
And you know, but I to speak to that, I do have friends who have. I remember a few years ago, a friend of mine. He goes, "Hey, I have Attack of the Clones. I got it ripped from the computer, and it's a good DVD quality."
Yeah.
And this was like a week before it opened. He goes, "You want it?" And this was just a personal thing. I didn't want it because. I don't want to be my first experiencing an Attack of the Clones.
On a computer.
On a computer or on, you know, even on TV. I want my first experience of
Attack
of the
Clones. And you don't want your first experience seeing Attack of the Clones to be illegal.
Yeah, and that was a big thing. Remember, there was people were actually fired and a pride at the employee who did that, I think in Industrial Light and Magic, was downed and, you know.
You know, it's so ironic because I knew someone that had the same thing. A pirated copy of Attack of the Clones. So if I knew someone and Aaron knew someone, how widespread did that have to be? We have a call on a 512 area code. Let's take this and then close out the show.
Sounds good.
512, go right ahead.
Hi, this is Sunny.
Hi, Sunny. How
Hi,
are
Sunny.
You?
Fine. I have another Blog Talk Radio show. But anyway, that's not the point.
Well, no, bring up your Blog Talk Radio show. We'd love
I
to hear about
it. I have two of them.
Okay, go right ahead.
My first one is called Air Ata Ka Talk.
Mm.
Okay.
Okay.
And there's four writers of erotica.
Oh,
I've heard of that. Okay.
I'm listening in. What time does that start?
I'm bookmarking.
That starts on midnight on Friday, Central Time.
Perfect.
And then I have a show after that called Sunny's Wind Down, because I get so excited about doing the show that I can't get to sleep, so I decided to make up another show. And that's just me talking about something. Last week it was By Curiosity.
Oh, wow.
And Dexter.
Oh, yeah.
All the Showtime.
Dexter's on right now.
See, and so part of that show has to do with movies since I'm kind of a movie person also. But what was my question now that I'm saying? I forgot. I'm getting old. Anyway, do the downloads? Do they have commentaries and everything on it? Because I love commentaries and how the thing was made.
I don't know if they have the commentaries.
No.
I'm not positive.
What is interesting, speaking of commentaries on computer, most, from what I understand, you can just download the movie and there's no commentary. But what is interesting, speaking of that, apparently Darren Aronofsky's commentary for his latest film, The Fountain.
You can download.
That you can download. While you don't have the film, you can download his commentary that Warner Brothers denied on the DVD. So
why did they deny that?
I'm assuming it's one of those things he probably cut too close to the bone.
Yeah, I think he was very sour towards the studio for it.
So yeah.
They probably didn't want him bad talking.
With Hugh Jackman and Rachel Weisz.
It's a good movie, but it didn't do well, and there's a lot of problems with the making of it, and
it's very challenging. It started out probably twice as epic, at least, as it is now, and
yeah.
Brad Pitt was to star.
Brad Pitt and Kate Blanchett were the original stars.
Well,
and they set it at a budget where they just had to bare bones it. And
I'm curious. We have a caller from 512. So you're calling from Austin?
Yes. Well,
I'm
from Texas.
Ostentatious,
we call it.
Yeah.
Ostentatious.
I'm San Antonio.
Really? Well,
yes.
Then you're just a hop, skip, and a jump.
Oh, I can't wait. Well, so you must go, just our last question, I guess, have you gone to the Alamo Draft House?
Oh, yes, it's my favorite place to go.
It is one of the great theaters in the country. It is a remarkable theater.
I understand there is more in the country than that type, that type of branch than just here in San Antonio, though.
Yeah. No, Alamo Draft House is wonderful. It's a wonderful theater.
Yeah,
I love it.
You read so much about it, too.
Yeah.
So Friday at midnight, and what's the airing of your second show?
It's right after that. It's
okay.
At Saturday at 1 a.m., and that's Central Time.
We will be listening out for it. And we appreciate you listening to us and calling us tonight. It's great to hear from you.
Well, I'll probably be calling more because I have so many questions about movies and cable shows on disc all the time.
Bring them on. Call us anytime you'd like.
Yeah, please.
And I'm sure Jerry will call into Erotica.
Yeah, I'll call in. Don't you worry about that.
Are you going to read something you wrote?
No, I'm just going to listen.
That's fine.
All right, Sunny. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
Yeah,
bye-bye
thank
now.
You. Bye.
Good to hear from a fellow Blog Talk Radio. And is that how you'd say that?
I think so. That's good. Well, that's good enough.
All right. So it's been a great show. 2 hours dedicated to the world of DVD. We finally got it going after a little glitch, but we made it through.
We will have Mike Clark at a later show. I can almost guarantee that sometime before the year is out, I'm pretty sure we will have Mike Clark.
We'll try to get him in here at the end of October.
And we should try to get both of them to have like a USA Today kind of roundtable.
Oh, so we can get the inside dirt on USA Today.
Well, not that. But no, it would be very interesting. I mean, both the guests were just incredible. I was really kind of blown away by.
So we're going to be it's been an exciting, terrific show. We're going to be taking a week off. We'll be back with you next week where we have a great lineup of guests, and Chris will be back with us, and we'll have a lot of fun, the movie geeks, between one another. One of our guests is Garrett Dillahunt. He's an actor who's in the new film, The Assassination of Jesse James, and the Coen brothers' No Country for Old Men. And we're currently negotiating some appearances by some other high-profile guests, and you won't want to miss that. Stay tuned to your blogs and bulletins to find out more information. That's it, gentlemen. Aaron, Jerry, thank you so much for tonight.
Thank you. And
I loved it.
It was wonderful.
Great. We will see you guys next week. Bye-bye.
Okay, great. Good night.
Bye-bye. Good night.